given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of ParaX, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Step outside of your comfort zone. See the world with a whole new perspective. Join us and experience the unexplained on The Paranormal View.
And welcome, everybody, right here to The Paranormal View on the ParaX Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for being with us tonight, those here in the chat room and those listening from around the world. We appreciate each and every one of you. If you do have questions tonight, you can private chat them to either myself, Henry Foister, or Ceiling Cat. And I don't see Jeffrey in the chat room.
I can't get in there. It's okay. It's, yeah.
Well, we'll get those questions answered for you. So just send them right on over to either one of us. And if you're listening from around the world, feel free to come over to para-x.com. Click on the chat now button at the top of the page, and you'll be in with all these wonderful people.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky. And if you have questions and you don't want to come over to the chat room, you can still ask your questions by sending them to theparanormalview@gmail.com. We will get those answered for you. So got a great show lined up for tonight. A couple of things actually before we get started tonight. We got our Gettysburg thing coming up April the 13th and 14th. So if you wanted to join us there, we got a couple of things lined up to do and be out on the battlefield and have a great time with a bunch of people. You can just send me a message. We'll get you on the list for you can get all the information for it and everything. So with that, tonight we have with us Jeffrey Gould.
Hello, hello.
And Barbara Duncan.
I'm here.
Yeah, she's here, hiding in the corner. Yeah. But anyway, glad everybody's here tonight. It's still cold where I'm at. It's sweltering hot out there where Jeff and Barbara is.
Actually, we get these brisk evenings, which are not that cold until the breezes come through, and then this bitter cold cuts through. It's not pleasant, but it's not, you know, it's not the same as what you've got, I'm sure.
So what's it like up north, Barbara?
Oh, it's in the 60s.
In the 60s. Well, it's not bad. It's better than what we got. We did get one. It was like 60 something or close to 70, I guess, one day last week. And they're saying we're going to get another 70 next week. And nice. In between, it stays down in the 20s and low 30s. So
well, we get really cold nights, but really toasty days.
Well, tonight we got a great guest. And Jeff, is there anything you guys got that you want to chime in? You're Barbara before we get started.
I got reordained and performed my first wedding down in Malibu the other day.
You did?
Yep. Friend of mine from online, and oddly enough, he's from Vegas, but he didn't want a cheesy wedding, so he and his now wife wanted to get married on the beach, so we went down to Malibu. And kind of got late the first day, so he says, I guess we'll do it tomorrow. So we did it the next day. And he had no witnesses, so we were fortunate to come across three very friendly young people who were witnesses and signed all the paperwork properly, and hooray.
All right.
Yeah, I posted some photos. I haven't got any of the photos of the actual ceremony yet, but I have photos of, like, at the beach and this one cute little sea lion that was at Santa Monica Pier later and stuff like that. My Instagram it real bad. Yeah.
So Barbara, you got anything going?
I don't know. Pretty quiet. No.
Barbara's the quiet one. We'll get her after a while though. Why don't you introduce our guest and we'll get started.
Yeah, well, living up in Canada, Robbie Thomas is a psychic medium, spiritualist counselor who internationally helps families and police fight against crime while bringing solace to those who need it. Being highly respected in the paranormal and spiritual fields of work, Robbie continues to be a great presence, working alongside many integral individuals in film, television, and radio, lending his ability to further along his experience as a spiritual visionary. Robbie is often called upon from the international community for assistance with his abilities, and a prolific best-selling author and writer in the metaphysical, spiritual, horror, paranormal genres. Robbie has published 9 books of his own and co-contributed to 4 others. And he's written television treatments, which either are in development or have been perused, and Psychic Profiler is in production and development with Lampert Shepherd Entertainment and Very Paranormal Television. And he's either starred in numerous projects as well as creating numerous projects, still completely forgetting that I'm an available SAG actor with a valid passport. So welcome back, Robbie Thomas.
Thank you for having me. That was the best intro ever. The latter part is the best.
Now,
like I say, I am available. I can come up to Canada. I don't mind.
Right now, we have so much snow, you can shovel my driveway. If that counts.
Well, I lived 4 years in North Dakota when I was in the service, and I know what snow is like up there.
I grew up in New Jersey, so in the 1960s, we had, 5-foot snow drifts and such.
Do you live in Canada?
I border Michigan.
Oh, close to it. Yeah, I was in Minot, North Dakota, and we went up to Canada one time shortly after I got up there on a weekend, went to Winnipeg.
And right. That's cool.
That's an old, old town, boy, let me tell you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I've got to meet Robbie, I don't know, quite a few times at different events and conventions. So we've been hanging out a lot, you might say. Some anyway. Yeah.
Well, when you come to Hollywood, let me know.
Oh, you know I will.
Now, you've been doing some things with Keith Age. Did you say you was filming? What kind of things were you doing?
Yeah, last year we went on a whirlwind tour throughout many different states, and it was the Midwest in conjunction in the middle there. We hit some pretty good locations. We wrapped up in Virginia. There's a story that's actually tied to Virginia that's in the book. We'll probably touch upon it later. But we wrapped up the series at the end of pretty much the end of November. And it was a great time. It was going into these different locations, some that were never, really looked at in the paranormal community that much or looked at all. And some of that were done or overdone many times, but still, in the essence of it all, we got some good stuff.
So, when did you first realize that you had the ability to see things or get impressions?
Going back as a child, age 2, 3. Fox did a special back in 1994. My mother passed away, but the day before she passed, that day that she passed, the night before, I had this vision, if you will, or visitation of the horseman. And I had that sleep paralysis where you can't move, but you can see what's going on. And they were explaining to me at age 28-ish, this is what's going to happen. And there's nothing you can do. It's going to be inevitable, but you're going to take it care of. Going back now to age 2, back in the old days in the 60s, if a lady had a baby at a wedlock, the Roman Catholic Church would take the baby and put it up for adoption. This man promised my mother the world. He fell through with his promise and did not marry her. She became pregnant and had a child. The child was given up for adoption. Years later, my mother meets my father, marries him, has me. Then you have this little kid running around I feel like I'm adopted or I have a sibling, a sister or something out there. And this must have plagued her. I knew it bothered her. You know, as a child, you don't realize this. Bringing it back in 1994, after the funeral of my mother, her side of the family took me aside. It was her brother and her sister. We went to the park, sat me down, and said, all these years, you were right. There is another child, and she's her name is Mary. So, you know, that blew my world apart. I'm just burying my mother. I get told to have another sibling. I was right all those years. And then somehow Fox found it, wanted to put this together as a goodwill story, and they did. And it was about meeting my sister and for the first time and me knowing it all those years. So I can remember and recall back to age two.
Wow.
That's an amazing jump. So from the age of two on, how were you able to handle it?
I wrote about that in my first book in 2003. And I talked about the peer pressure growing up as a child into the adolescence. And if my peers found out, I knew I would be crushed because they would make fun of me. So it just stayed within me. I talked to my mother a lot. She knew I had this ability. It was a lot of turmoil, learning on my own, learning how to decipher, how to, you know, expel what's good and what's bad and seeing things happen, knowing they were going to happen. My teenage years, age 13, my father buys this house. I'm going to be going to a school named St. Patrick's High School. Man in the home died and they had a fire in the house. So we renovated that all summer long, finally finished it. And then I go to pull, turn the light off, and it was an August night, go to climb in bed. I shut the light off and I turn, beautiful moonlight coming in the window, by the way. And there he was. It was a shadow person, somebody dark, dark outline, brim hat, overalls. I made out everything. And I pulled the covers over my head, screamed. And of course my mother came in, turned the light on, and he was gone. Well, this kept going on for a while. And I got to introduced to this gentleman who lived in the home. Later, as the introduction went on, I learned from him the three gentlemen across the way who were adjacent from the house that we lived in were friends, or really good friends, with the man who died in the house. And Cecil Leach, Mr. Waters, Mr. Harding, all three of them in a row. And they told me they were going to die very close together and soon. Well, Mr. Leach was a very stout man, very stout. I remember sitting on the front porch of my father that one summer and watching Mr. Leach come across the road, as he always did, come on the front porch to talk to my dad, and he was holding his pants. And he got so skinny so fast, and he had cancer, and he ended up passing away that summer. And then Mr. Waters passed away with a heart attack, and then Mr. Harding died in a hunting accident. So it was all very close to what this gentleman was teaching me, I guess, if you will, in the home. So that, you know, that's my teenage years. And then learning about that. It was something else. It was a very educational, I'll tell you that.
So I guess going to a library, all of that's kind of out of the question too, because in small towns, I guess word would get around for checking out weird books.
Yeah.
There's something about small towns that does that. Sure.
Small towns. You know, looking at the way of growing up in that home and what took place, I wasn't very shy and glad that we moved out of the house. It was different, and it wasn't like evil, but it was very educational and learning about being told what was going to happen, being shown what was going to, you know, become of this person and what have you. And I learned quick.
learning quick on how to hide it, or learning quick on how to
or both.
Actually say what you need to say.
Yeah, learning to achieve the ability to express myself and knowing, okay, this isn't really bad. This is something that, you know, I can expand on. And then when I became age of 17, I did a police test, and I was going through to be a police officer. I got hired and fired the same day because you had to be 20 years of age. That was in the book. And then bringing you fast forward, I continued on because I really wanted to be a police officer. So on age 20, 21, I went through and I got hired on a town outside of Toronto, Canada. Now, as we came home and the testing was all finished off, I'm sitting in the kitchen and I hear this lady screaming, accident, accident. So I ran out the back door, I hopped the fence, and there's this lady in a robe and she's pointing out towards the driveway of this long set of townhomes. So I'm running. I'm looking at the ground, I'm looking around the corner, and I start to curve around the road, and I'm looking for cars because I heard accident. There was nothing. And then this gentleman to my left yells, over here. And I look to the townhome. He had the screen door open, and he's waving me over. So I ran over to him, and he pulls me in. As I get into the kitchen, I turn and I look to my left. There's a lady running around the table screaming, and there's a gentleman to my right holding a doorknob. So he waves me over. Now I'm over towards him, and I'm looking on the floor for blood because I was told in the beginning, accident. He opens the door, grabs me, pushes me in, shuts the door. It didn't dawn on me, but I'm still looking at the floor for blood, and I look up, and there's a gentleman in there in this little bathroom, and he's looking directly at me, got blue lips, looks clammy. So now the CPR, the mode of first aid, everything starts to kick in. And I'm over there, and I'm touching him for vitals. And I look at him, I go to start to do CPR, and I hear, let me go. And I step back for a second, and I know I had this ability, but it's still not kicking in. I didn't hear that. So then I go to do CPR again, and I hear really loud, let me go. So as I step back and look at this man who's looking at me, and I'm looking in his eyes, you can see that he is not there, and I did hear that. So I stepped out of the room. There was two people in that one room at the time I went in, or three, the one by the door. Now there's 15 people or more, and they're all staring. You could hear a pin drop. And sure enough, you know, my father comes in the side door late because he had to run around. He couldn't hop the fence. And he says, well, and I looked at him, and I started shaking my head, and everybody starts screaming. Come to find out through the coroner that the gentleman who died had a massive coronary. His heart had ripped. There was no way of being able to save him anyways. And then I find out through my sister, it was her best friend's father. And that was very just uncanny. So I ended up going to the funeral for him. I felt bad about it, and I knew what he told me. And, you know, it's just something that I live with.
I must be really, well, I mean, for a police officer, even an EMT, to have to hear that, knowing that you can't do anything but, you know, obligations as a fireman or a police officer to continue CPR.
Yeah, it's
That's got to be tough.
It is. And you become, I was like distraught, but I wasn't, you know, upset in that kind of manner. So what I did was I ended up calling where I was hired on. I said, I don't feel like being a police officer. I really don't. I have an idea what I'm going to do, but it's not a police officer. I know I'm going to help in the law and strive in that avenue, but I just know I'm not going to. They didn't understand that. They said, you can't. Once you be hired on, you just don't quit. So they said, we want to send the captain and the sergeant over to your house. And the phone call started. Then they said they were making a working tool movie. And they sent the film crew, the captain, the sergeant, and they set up in the house and they started filming. And we went through a bunch of questions. The very last question that was asked was, why did I quit? Why did I get hired and then just decide to quit? Was it under duress? And I looked at him and I said, no, I wasn't stressed out. I wasn't stressed at all. I just heard him tell me, let him go. He did not want any help to be revived. Otherwise, we found out later, there was no way of reviving him. He had a massive coronary. And, I'm looking at the camera crew. I'm looking at the captain and the sergeant. And they're just staring at me like, is he nuts? And I wasn't. I was just telling them. And that was the first movie I was ever in. I was 21 years of age. And it's a working tool for EMTs, firefighters, and police officers who quit under duress. But I kept telling them, I'm not stressed. I just know what I'm going to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's got to be difficult, like I said, even nursing. When you know a patient's long since gone, where does the obligation to stop?
Yeah, because you have that tie. And nursing, daughter's going through for nursing right now. And, you know, God bless the nurses. Without nurses, we need nurses. They become so tied to patients. They're their second window, I call it, because they're emotionally tied. They love each other. They love the patients. So, it's got to be very hard for them.
Now, Robbie, when you get these calls, like this gentleman, for example, are you empathetic to the actual issue? By that I mean, do you feel the pain, or do you feel the issues that are happening to the person?
Yeah, on many different murder cases, I explain what goes on, what's entailed from, when I'm on scene, and I've actually had the opportunity to sit with suspects and murderers and tell them how I feel. I know what they did, recording them and profiling them with detectives. It's something, it's really, but information comes down and I see it. I'm explaining about the little boy and what's happening to him. I see a closet where he kept them. I felt the break, the meaning that he's being murdered now. I can feel it. It's a terrible feeling to go through. And then I get very upset because I'm human, and I write about that in there. Then you take all those feelings, all those subjective visions you have, put them on paper, and I'm hundreds or thousands of miles away from people, and I send that to the detective, and they turn around and go, oh my gosh, that's everything that took place. That's everything that you have. You gave the murderer's name. You gave the location of where the murderer lives. And you found the body, and you're not even close to being here. It's something that, how can I say it? It really does eat at you. It makes you feel vulnerable. I feel vulnerable. I feel anger, a lot of anger when I do children cases, at the situation, at the fact that this is going on. It shouldn't be going on. And, when I'm on scene, it's even heightened hundredfold. It's a lot different. When I'm talking to a suspect, and the detective we're playing the good cop, bad cop scenario, and the detective's had enough, and he goes, you know what? He profiled you, and he opens up the SUV doors, he pulls out the Bristol board I wrote on, shuts the doors, and puts it on the SUV, and he goes, now you SUV, and the suspect's looking at it, and he's just reading the three columns, and he's turning white, and he's just shaking his head, yes, and I'm waiting for him to say yes. I'm holding the recorder under his mouth. And so then I get into it with him because Andy couldn't get anything out of him. So I started telling him, I said, I know you did it. I know you were there. I know you didn't actually do the act of killing them, but you still took part in this. I know what went on. I know the feeling of what the fire, I know how they were cut and gutted. I was there. I seen it. And then you see him looking at me like, how did you know this? And he starts to shake his head. He goes, yes. So, feel these things. I see it, I smell it, taste it, and it's something that's very difficult. I wouldn't wish this on anybody. I would not, say, Barbara, you should see how this really is, because no one should be able to see this.
Well, it brings me a question. And you see it from both perspectives, both the victim and the perpetrator.
Yeah, I see everything from beginning to end. It's difficult. You know, how can I say? Sometimes cases get solved in minutes. Sometimes they get solved. The information that comes across and how I feel, and I give my perspective on what I see, what I feel, what I'm enveloped in to the detective. Now, they have to take that and piece it together. Sometimes it's really quick. Sometimes it's weeks or days, months or a year. But when it's done, it's solved. And in the book itself, I mean, there's two copies of this book. There's the bonus book, and then there's the one that's on Amazon. The bonus book has 15 cases. I know people say, you know, I could see one, a fluke, maybe two. Yeah, but there's 15. I put in volume one, by the way. It's only volume one. I could write volume two, three, four, all kinds of cases. But it's just to show and illustrate the true feeling of somebody who goes through the motions, like you explained, the empathy, the apathy, the fact that, you know, I become that situation. And then I remember, Barbara, looking at the detective's face on different cases, and they're staring at me, and then they walk up to me and they go, I don't know how you do it. I've heard that from every detective from Washington to right in Canada here to, you know, oh my gosh, Kentucky, all over. And I just tell them, I'm just part of a tool that is part of you. And together, we're working together to solve these crimes, to bring solace to families.
And we're talking about Robbie's book, Psychic Profiler, The Real Deal. And he sent a portion of it to us so we could read it and be able to ask a lot of questions and stuff and go over it. There's a lot of interesting cases that you had in here. I think that your first case in the book was you talk about this guy, Jesse. You seen him walking across the parking lot because you was with another guy when you seen that. And I guess you was talking to the guy anyway. You went up to where he lived and started talking to this Jesse, and out of the blue kind of, why did he just out of the blue confess to you that he and another man killed a guy?
I was going through, and remember, I was going through to be a police officer at that age, that time. It was 1990. This is my first case, 28 years ago. I put the very first case in the book, and that, you know, to show people the fact that, you know, it goes back that far. What he started to divulge to me, there was a line of questioning that I was given to him, like, what do you do with your life, you know, in that line of questioning, like I just seen black shroud, you know, take people back. I'm in the parking lot with Greg, a friend of mine who managed this apartment building or complex. And it was a nice sunny day. And I'm speaking to Greg over his shoulder. This gentleman's walking behind him. He had black all around him. And I knew from growing up as a kid, everything black was evil. Everything was that anybody who had anything emanating from them black, that much like a shroud, there was something wrong. So I kept staring at him over Greg's shoulder, and my head kept turning. And Greg noticed I wasn't looking at him anymore, but staring at AKA Jesse walking in the building. Greg turns to look what I was looking at, turns to me and says, that's Jesse. You want to go meet him? And I said, yeah. So we eventually made it up into Jesse's apartment. Now picture a 5 foot nothing sawed off Eddie Van Halen. This guy was a replica of that. We're sitting inside his apartment. His girlfriend's pregnant. She's there. Greg's on the couch to my left. Jesse is about, 2 feet, 3 feet from me on this one chair. And I just started questioning, like, what do you do for a living? What do you do for your life? And, you know, that tone and going into there's something going on. And all of a sudden, he caught on quick. You know, these murderers, they know. They're conniving. They just No. He stands up, walks over to me, and tells me to stand up. I did. He lifted up my shirt, and as he was doing, he goes, "Are you effing hot?" And I didn't know what he meant. At that time, I was aloof to what was going on. I mean, he's reaching for my shirt. He's pulling it up, and all of a sudden, he's patting me down, looking around. Then I knew. He was looking for a wire. He'd been lying to questioning. And I'm a straightforward guy, and I'm asking him straight questions. And then all of a sudden, now he's asking me if I have, pat me down if I had a wire. He pushes me down in the chair, and he says, "You want to know?" And he goes, held his hand sideways like a thug would hold his hand, like with a gun. And he goes, with the motion in and out, he goes, "We popped him like a rabbit. You should have seen him hopping." And I'm listening to this kid tell me this. And his girlfriend now is pacing back and forth from this little cubbyhole dining room area into the living room. And he stands up and smacks her and tells her to shut up. And then he starts telling how what was going on, where they ran. And then he says, "I'm going to have an alibi." And then I'm getting all this information from this guy. And then Greg, by now, is at the door going out of the apartment because he's freaking out. Jesse asked me to leave. We're leaving.
Uh-oh, where'd he go?
I almost thought I fell off.
No. Well, it doesn't look like he fell off.
Uh-oh.
It shows he's still on.
Yeah, but how often has that said I've been still on and nobody can hear me and I can't hear anybody? Welcome to Skype.
No, it shows that he's still on, so...
I wonder if he knows we can't hear him and he's just talking and talking. Which I've done. How often have I done that? I'll be talking and all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I'm not even on the call anymore, okay?
Well, there's not a way for me to send him a message unless I get onto Facebook, I guess.
Yeah, but he would have to be on Facebook to know that you sent him a message.
Right. So, I tell you what we can do. I can try and call him. I can hang up on him and then call him back, I guess. But we can try that.
Yeah.
That might be wise. It's time for a commercial anyway.
Yeah. So.
Pardon me. Normally I'm muted, and all of a sudden I got something tickling my throat.
All right, we'll do that. Oh, I can't play commercials and call him too, though. So,
no.
Would you guys talk just a second, and let me see if I can get him back on here. Then I'll wait for because this has to go off before I can call him back. So
there you go.
Let it get disconnected here. Excuse me. And then
live TV.
Yeah,
live radio. Yay. So I saw Black Panther this morning and it's fantastic. It's one of the best Marvel movies out so far.
Awesome.
Sorry?
I said awesome.
Yeah. So and
still waiting for Ant-Man to
Hello?
Hello? Oh yeah, that's gonna be great.
Back on now.
I can't hear him.
Hi, this is Robbie Thomas. I'm not available right now, but if you leave me your name and number, I will get back to you.
So why didn't he foresee this coming?
I don't know. Well, you don't foresee it coming. That's something that just happens. I don't know. So
like an old cartoon I saw of a car full of psychics going to a convention, and... the sign says road out. He says, well, how was I supposed to know that the road was going to be washed out?
Okay. Well, let me try it a different way then. And,
smoking.
Okay. He's on Facebook. Let me get on over there.
Yay.
And, hang on a minute, guys. So you guys go ahead and talk for a minute while I try to,
there you go.
To do this here.
Let's see. I came across a commercial that I had done background back in August for no good reason, I'm thinking, I haven't thought about that for a while. I should see if it's online. And I found, a good frame grab of it with me right there. And then I found it on YouTube. So if anybody wants to look up Buffalo Wild Wings Dragon as a search term, you'll bring up this amusing little thing set in medieval times. And when the guy is offering up buffalo wings in medieval times to this other gentleman, he's got a little dragon to make it burst fire onto the chicken wings. Right over the standing guy's shoulder is me, and I lean back and talk to the row behind me. And yay. And I'm still waiting for the other commercial I did.
Okay, I'm going to try and call him back now, see if this will work.
Yay. Always difficult.
Yeah.
Cell phone lost coverage. Drop your call and you'll never know it. It never fails.
Oh, yeah. Well, my brother's coming into town in a week and a half. Get to see him for a day, hanging out.
You gotta go to the Queen Mary.
Hello.
That's a good idea. Yeah. I don't know if he's ever been to the
Queen Mary. Welcome.
Hey, Robbie, how you doing?
Welcome back.
You were talking, and all of a sudden, you wasn't talking anymore. We didn't hear anything.
Oh, my goodness. What part did you guys miss?
All of what we didn't hear.
Your friend was running out of the apartment, and you were about to run out, too.
Oh, okay. There. We ended up about there.
Yeah.
Well, Greg, by this time, is at the door and getting out to the hallway. And then I ended up at the door by being told to leave. And as we get to the door, Jesse grabs my shoulder, pulls me into him, and says, if I tell anybody, he's going to kill me. But not to worry, because he's going to get off on an alibi. They had it all fixed. They knew what was going on. So he shoves me out the door. Me and Greg end up down in his apartment now. We're discussing what just happened. He's freaking out. Talk to his wife. I end up leaving, going to talk to the detectives. I'm talking to the detectives on the phone. I'm explaining to them everything that transpired in the apartment. The detective tells me, you have to go back and befriend this guy and wear a wire. I had some explicit words to say, and I said, I'm not, because he just told me he's going to kill me. He made me. He already looked for a wire, and they said, no, you don't understand. We're actually in court with this guy this week coming over a murder of Mark Campbell, and that's when it all came down. I learned that they were in this murder, what he did, what he explained. I said, oh, my gosh, there's no way. And that was my first case. It was a lesson well learned.
So did they ever actually get the guy for the murder?
They went to court, and they did get off on an alibi. Everything he told me how they would get off, they got off. Here's the thing, though, and I didn't write this in the book. Thomas Cook, who's the partner of AKA Jesse, they were ripping off a car stereo across the way from the gas station. They weren't having any luck with the car stereo. They went over to rob the gas station, and that's how Mark got shot. Thomas Cook ended up, years later, tying his girlfriend's hands behind her back, saran wrapping her head so she couldn't breathe, and he watched her die in front of him, and he turned himself in. That's his second murder, and he's in jail for life. And Jesse, a.k.a. Jesse, is out west in Canada. He moved from this town.
Wow. And they never did get him for anything. Jeez.
No, they got off on an alibi. And once you get acquitted, that's it. You can't go back and charge him for murder.
Right. Wow. Well, I think what we're going to do now is take a quick break since we didn't get to a few minutes ago. And it won't be real long. We'll get Jeff to take us out, and then I'll bring us back. So stay tuned, everybody. We'll have more in just a minute. Go ahead, Jeff.
I think you pretty much said that we're listening to The Paranormal View on para-x.com with your hosts, Henry Foyster, Ceiling Cat, Barbara Duncan, and myself, Jeffrey Gould, with tonight's returning guest, psychic criminal profile and author, Robbie Thomas. So one could stay tuned for more of The Paranormal View after the break. So I guess I don't have to say any of that.
It's always time for the dead to shine in Hollywood. The legendary Dearly Departed Tours has stepped up their ghostly game by offering the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour. Dearly Departed has long been an orb of hope in the paranormal world, having been featured on television's Haunted History and Haunted Collector. Their terrible tales have been made infamous in Marla Brooks' The Ghosts of Hollywood books. The new Ghosts and Legends Tour is a 10-block, 70-minute dusk-time stroll down the boulevard of broken dreams. You'll be guided through the golden age of Hollywood and see where the unearthly Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney, and the calamitous Black Dahlia are still said to linger. You'll see Hollywood's gothic hotels, legendary theaters, and restaurants, never forgetting their permanent occupants. No stranger to investigations, Dearly Departed Tours has first-hand knowledge of some of these hauntings. For details of the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour, find Dearly Departed Tours on Facebook, dearlydepartedtours.com, or call 1-855-600-DEAD. It's always time for the dead to shine in Hollywood. The legendary Dearly...
Hi, this is Mike from Mr. G's Ice Cream Store in Gettysburg, the most haunted ice cream store in town. Stop in and see us next time you're around. We feature 16 flavors of homemade ice cream made right here in the store. Look forward to seeing you.
So, Tim, around here at Para-X, we're considered oldies because we've been here so long, right?
You know, yeah, but, you know, there's nothing wrong with oldies. In fact, you know what? I really love oldies.
Well, yeah, me too. I mean, it kind of takes me back to a time when my cauldron had training wheels and the Black Cat Lounge was called the Black Kitten Lounge. Sometimes I miss the good old days.
Sis, there's no need to miss them at all, because all you'll have to do is turn on and listen to Rock with the Shock.
Rock with the Who?
No, 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 little sis. No, 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 not the Who. The Shock.
Are you psychic? Do you often have dreams that come true? Do you have an interest in hypnosis or astrology? If you'd like to learn more about classes, events, and books on metaphysics, then go to our website, www.theartofmediumship.com. This is Elaine Kosmaskis, director of the New England School of Metaphysics and author of The Art of Mediumship.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
And welcome back, everybody, right here to the Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for being here with us tonight, those in the chat room and those listening from around the world. And speaking of around the world, Barbara, where do we have listeners at?
Tonight they're in the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, Ireland, and Unknown is back.
Right. I'm glad to see that Unknown's always hanging here with us. No telling where they're from. Of course, we got Robbie with us. He might be able to tell us where they're at.
They're in your chat room.
So we got with us tonight Robbie Thomas, and I assume you're with us.
I'm here with you.
And we got Barbara Duncan.
Yep.
Oh. And Jeffrey Gould.
Yes. Yes, sorry.
Yeah, you might try to fake the female voice, but it didn't work too good, Jeff.
I'm used to your actually mentioning me first. Sorry, I was went into a little autopilot there while I'm typing.
Oh, all right. Well, we were talking about some of the cases out of your book, and a lot of interesting ones. We were just talking about Jesse and everything, and which was interesting because you didn't have in the book about the other guy killing his wife and turning himself in, and then Jesse moving out west after they got off. Yeah. So it was interesting to see what all took place on that. There is some others in here that I thought was really interesting. And I know you get phone calls from people, I guess, all around the states of them having a problem or something and wanting you to help them. When you get a call from somebody and they're wanting you to do something, you don't run to where they're at most of the time. You do a lot of stuff like what you call channeling.
True.
But there are times when you actually go to where the people are at and help them. I know you were in this next one, you were filming, I guess, in Virginia somewhere. It took place in November 17th, 2017. Which is recent, by the way, just this past fall. And a woman called, said she needed your help, and you were busy filming and wasn't able to go to her right then, but you did after you got done with what it was you was doing in Virginia. Which was an interesting story about Julia, was it Kiff?
Yes, correct.
Why don't you tell us that story?
Yeah. We were wrapping up our coexistence paranormal supernatural television series shoot in Virginia. And as I just arrived in Virginia on the Friday, I get this text message saying, can I help? That she was in a desperate plea because her husband was in the ICU, and or did I know of anybody who could do a read or was capable of doing what I do. And I said, I don't know anybody in that area. I just don't know anybody that's capable of doing that. I don't know anybody in that area. And she goes, okay, can I help? And I said, well, look, if you could tell the doctors to hang tough and wait, I could be back on Tuesday. I just got in Virginia filming on Friday. She said she would do her best. We filmed Friday, Saturday, and a bit on Sunday we were leaving. I was so tired staying up all night long for all this filming and then having them on my mind, because my focus was Mr. Kiff, Bill Kiff, who was declared brain dead, and they wanted to take him off life support. They wanted to end his life, and his wife reached out at the 11th hour, and they agreed to wait just one more day. So then I jumped in the car with my wife and I drove 12 hours straight through, and I got all the way back to Canada. I'm really tired, you know, just really fatigued from the whole weekend of being up, getting maybe 3 hours, 4 hours sleep at the most, and then driving 12 hours to get to Canada, staying, not sleeping that night either, and then getting early morning into the hospital. So as I walk up into the hospital, I go towards the ICU unit, and there's Julie sitting in the waiting room. She comes over and gives me a hug, and I give her a hug, and she punches in the code number to go into the actual ICU because it's secured. I walk in there, she shows me her husband, who's hooked up to every machine that you could possibly think. I've never seen a human being hooked up that way before, with tubes coming out of the sides of their body and out of their mouth and IVs, and it was all over. He was tubes everywhere. He wasn't there. And what took place was I took my hat off. And, you know, before this, she explained to me, before this part, she explained to me that they were going to take him off life support, pull the plug in his life. And she was distraught. She was not herself. I took my hat off and I prayed to Jesus. That's my faith. That's my Savior. I prayed to Jesus, and I asked him, I need to hear something. I need to hear Bill say something. Anything, please, God, just tell me something. And then within 3 minutes, I heard, it's the wrong medicine. His brain is swollen. It's going to take time to heal. And a couple other things. I turned out of prayer. I turned to Julie. And immediately she said, oh, it's not good. And I said, no, no, no. And I hugged her. And I started explaining to her that what I heard was it's the wrong medicine they're giving him. His brain is swollen. And it's going to take time to heal. And then all of a sudden, his mom came in. I don't know where Bill's mom was at the time, but she came in, a little lady. She hugged me, and she was strong. Because when I tried to pull away, she was holding me. She looked me right in the eyes and said, thank you. Then I let them have their moment so they could talk to the neurologist, highly educated scientific individuals in the ICU unit were waiting. And I left. I get a text message call a couple hours at the most later, and it's Julie. She said that when she explained to the doctor, the neurologist, that what I said, he was kind of perplexed, and he asked for the chart. He looked at the chart and immediately said, pull the IVs. They pulled the IVs, and rehab started. They didn't pull the plug, and Bill is alive today. He's home, he's talking, he's eating, he's breathing, he can't walk very well, he's still weak, but it's going to take time, like I said, it's going to take time to heal, and sure enough, if I didn't go there and do 3 minutes of prayer and heard what I heard, or say what I said, they were going to pull the plug and Bill would have been not here. And that was a Christmas miracle for Julie in her family.
So
that's amazing that the doctors listened.
There was amazing. There was some type, you know what, there's divine intervention, because what in the first place, Barbara, why did they say, yeah, okay, we'll wait an extra day for him to come home? Like, in any scope of thinking, doctors, they're doctors. They're highly educated, scientific people. So for some divine intervention, it took place. And we come back, and we're talking, and I'm telling her exactly what took place or what went on from that prayer, or just a couple moments of hearing whatever Bill told me through the subconscious. I mean, saved his life. She wrote a letter in the book that explains in detail what went on. She validates that whole story.
Wow.
That's just totally amazing.
Jeff, are you typing?
Yeah. I was actually putting into the little chat explaining that with Skype's wonderfully whoever criminally insane person redesigned Skype, that when you try and recall me, it rings, but there's no icon anywhere on the screen saying, here's where to click to pick up. So I'm like, where, how? Bleh. So I had to quit Skype and reopen it, and that's when the thing came up. Oh.
Yay.
Anyway, you'll have to mute it when you're typing.
Fine.
Yeah. question from the chat room, and it actually kind of ties into this, and that is, can you see alternate futures or present possibilities, so that when you look at a situation like that, do you see that there's possibly more than one outcome to a situation?
Yeah. This is going to really heighten Jeffrey's awareness here. I'm speaking to Mark Tillman. You know who Mark Tillman is, don't you?
Sounds familiar.
He is the actual casting director for Stephen King's It, the first one. RoboCop, MacGyver. He did all those shows. I'm on the phone to him, and I'm on the phone to Don Hutchison from Liftoff Productions, and I was writing a movie script called Time Shift. During this, I call it an episode. I really do. During this time, I'm writing feverishly, and I'm just going like crazy. This script turned into a book, but I typed in 9.0 earthquake off the coast of Japan, the Black Abyss, back in March 2011, prior to it actually happening. And on my Facebook, you can go back, Jeffrey, and take a look at that week prior to that happening. There's certain notations I make that things are going to happen. It's going to be a catastrophe. My last statement was to everybody the night before it happened. I said, what's about to happen tomorrow, we all have to accept and move forward from this. And there's a few other choice words that were all added in there. So the next morning, and the script was already done, and that was already on Facebook. Already had the phone calls to Mark Tillman and Don Hutchison from Liftoff Productions. And Don actually wrote a little excerpt, put it in the book, that it was a remarkable call. And he gives his notation on what took place. The next morning, that earthquake happened. It registered at 8.9, and then they ended up changing it to 9.0, and my phone didn't stop ringing. It was Don, it was everybody down in Hollywood where you are, and it was amazing having everybody call me saying, you hit that, right? And it wasn't, I just seen it. I was writing a book, or sorry, a script, but then I stopped, and I said, this has to be into a book now. So I turned it over into a book. The book is called Time Shift, The Paradigm, and in that book, when it got published in 2012, 9 more major events that happened in the world came true, like the meteor over Russia that exploded, and how the Russians turned the finger and pointed over to the States and said it was HAARP, and all that all came true in the news. But I already wrote about it a year prior too, and it's all in the book.
Now, do you find that, I'm not sure how it's received. Do you find that if you predict things like this, that people change their behavior as to avoid it?
You can't stop the inevitable. I learned that a long time ago. Going back to the current book, Psychic Profile of the Real Deal, I seen where Victoria Stafford was going to go missing 2 days before she went missing. Now, the way I can back this up is, I went on a show called Fox FM 99.9, had the program director, and there's a clip on my website people can listen to, RobbieThomas.net, and the murder cases tab. He states he looked at all the information I had before they investigated this case, and he goes, I was a skeptic, but now I'm a believer. And he goes, I remember you showing me everything. And so, you know, when I see things like that, there's nothing you can do to stop the inevitable. It's not up to me, and Barbara wouldn't be up to you. It's that you're getting told something's going to happen. You're going to be the catalyst, as I've learned, and I'm assuming from all these years of me doing this that this is the prerequisite of what's happening, is that I'm the catalyst and something's going to happen. I'm the after effect. I came in after and help.
So it's almost like the old classic Greek legends, that if somebody is foretold something by a soothsayer and they try and avoid it, they end up actually causing it to happen.
You know, I would believe so, Jeffrey. I mean, like, I don't want to be the bearer of bad news either. You know, it's I don't know how to explain it. It's something that's there. It happens. You get this information, and I start my sketches right away. I started them. I put the pile of rocks. I put the tree line. I put the wagon wheels. I put the laneway. Sure enough, her body was found right by the big pile of rocks in the tree line where the Mennonites went. And all that validation I'm telling you is in the book, from the emails that I got from the grandmother, the letter from the families in there. I mean, I put every case, I made sure it was closed tight with all the information that's proven. So when people read a case, and there's 15, they read one, they go, I see the detective's letter validates him. I see the letter from the family that validates him. I see the emails, the text messages, and the photographs. They're all in there, and it seals the deal. the reason why this book too, is just not because of, hey, I did the murder case, I solved it, or hey, I brought this person home alive from the sex slave trade, or, you know, hey, I found the elderly lady who was endangered within an hour getting a phone call from Florida police. It's not because of it. It's to show families not to give up hope and faith and read between the lines. And there's a lot of good information in there for their children so that they could safeguard them. You know, it's a big encompassing book, and I worked on it for 8 years. So I'm trying to get the message out to people.
So you indicated that Time Shift was a treatment. Has that ever been greenlit or anything, or anyone take an interest in it?
You know, it never got to being greenlit. It turned into the book, released the book. It became a bestseller in Germany, hit number 3. United States, I think it got up to maybe 100 and something, but it sold well. On the site, like on my website, there's a lot of different critics who have read it and said what they feel about it. And there's news links. So everything that happened post of it being published, it shows like CNN link and shows all the different things that happened. Like the one that's right on the cover is the Mayan temple, the Mayan calendar, and I show it's burning. And I had Scotty Roberts write my foreword, and I said to him, they're going to find that. And the 12th Bucktoon, it doesn't exist. We're going on. It's not that we're going to end. And this was 2012, and everybody's going, oh, the Mayans, we're going to end. No. And it was like, I think, oh my goodness, that came out May. And if you Google it and people take a look, when they found that calendar in the cave, it was just shortly after that. But my book came out first, and it showed the temple or the calendar on the front cover, meaning we're going to continue on. So that was like another vision that put up right on the front cover.
Huh. I like it. Well, I'm also in your book, and I find it absolutely fascinating how you zero in on people. Also, there was a gentleman in the audience that you singled out because he had a phone on and was recording what you were saying for some sort of illicit purpose. I'm going to let you try to explain that, but it's fascinating that you're also seeing things as they're happening.
Yeah, it's I was working with the U.S. Marshals and the firebomb expert. I won't say his last name. His name is Jeff.
Yay!
And, yay! Good name, Jeff.
How do you spell it?
Yeah. J-E-F-F. Well, we were close. But very, very intricate case. So I'm doing the speak to for the family, and it was in a hotel, but we got this big congregation area. It filled up. I mean, it was wall to wall people, and it was just more than family. It was like the town came out. It was so packed. And there is the U.S. Marshal with a trolley cart with case files on it. I didn't want to see anything. The night before, I told private investigator Roger Saunders, I wrote down on a piece of paper all my thoughts, everything I seen. I said, put that in your pocket, hang on to it till we get, and I start talking. So I'm explaining what's going on, what I see, how he shot, what took place, because all they sent me was a photograph of a house before I went to Ohio. It was the back end of the house. I couldn't see no window, no doors, nothing, just the back end of a wall. And he was very tight-lipped, the U.S. Marshal, Jeff. And so went in there and I started explaining stuff. And when I started talking about insurance policy, and where the money went, about walls being torn apart late at night and something of the weapon being put into the wall, and then people gasping and saying, oh my gosh, the night that he was killed, his estranged wife had people over in the middle of the night ripping walls apart, putting new drywall up. And they said, well, where do you think the gun is? It's behind the wall. And then an insurance policy, and then Jeff stops everything and he goes, there's no way you could have known about those insurance policies and all that down to the T. And then I turned to Roger and I said, Roger, can I have that piece of paper? And Roger pulled it out and I said, okay, you read it. And Roger reads it to him and everybody's blown away. So I wanted to show everybody I'm on cue. I'm right. I'm right with everybody and we're doing the right thing. So then I look down the aisle and I see this guy and he's on his phone. He's facing me. I know who's on that phone. It's the perpetrators. And he is part of, he's playing like devil's advocate, sitting on the fence for the family and for them. So I had some few choice words. I walked down the aisle and I said to him, is that an effing phone? You know, I'm human. I'm speaking human. And I'm looking at this guy and he looks at me and I said, not in my meeting. And he turns and shuts it off and he bolts for the door and he takes off. I said enough because I knew the people on the other line would hear exactly what I was saying. I was setting them up to let them know that I'm on the hunt for them. And so, you know, to make them aware that we're there, what we're doing. That was really something else during that time.
Okay, I have to ask, did they get caught?
The one guy who murdered Robert, right now, at this present time, there's a guy in jail who got information from the man who actually pulled the trigger. He says he wants help to get off drugs. He's not asking for anything. No time off his sentence. No nothing at all. He wants help with drugs. He has an addiction. And in light of that, he'll tell exactly what this individual did, where everything is, the gun and everything. So that's the point we're at right now.
Wow. I think we're going to go ahead and take our last break real quick. I'll let Jeff take us out this time. I won't sing.
Well, you're listening to The Paranormal View on para-x.com with your hosts, Henry Foister, Celine Cat, Barbara Duncan, and myself, Jeffrey Gould, with tonight's returning guest, psychic criminal profiler and author, Rob Thomas. So stay tuned for more of The Paranormal View after the break.
I found it at last! Marla's Sacred Cauldron. This is the legendary artifact that has been whispered about in hushed tones for hundreds of years, and now it's mine! All mine!
Who dares defile the sanctity of my castle walls? Step away from the cauldron, you impertinent, muddy metal maltworm.
Never! I've spent half my lifetime trying to discover your age-old secret of stirring the cauldron!
Oh, for Merlin's sake, that's no deep, dark secret. Just tune into the Para-X Radio Network Thursday nights at 9 o'clock Eastern for more cauldron stirring than you can shake a wand at.
Oh, well, in that case, I guess I don't need to take up any more of your time, so I guess I'll be going!
Not just yet. We've got a little unfinished business to take care of.
That's Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Para-X Radio Network.
Hey there. I don't know if you've heard, but there's a great new radio show on Para-X. Two hosts, 1 hour, and too much fun. Stephanie and Heidi not only talk about the latest goings-on in the supernatural worlds, they live it. They want to hear from you. They want to help you understand and guide you. And they want you to tune in. So, grab a friend or come alone to gather around that metaphysical table with Heidi and Stephanie. If you're interested in the worlds of the unseen, tune in to The Gathering Radio Show, Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern on Para-X Radio.
Oh. Hi, this is Master Tarot Card Reader Ken Bogle, and I highly encourage you to tune in every Monday night to the ParaX Radio Network for the ParaCave, hosted by Matt Jesso, as he goes in search of the truth in the supernatural, metaphysical, mystic, and paranormal. Monday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern, only on the ParaX Radio Network. I never miss it, and neither should you.
Rat! Rat! Where are you going?
I'm going back to the paranormal view, back where I belong.
Please, please, take me with you.
No, I'm through with everything here. I want to see if there's something left in life I haven't explored. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Rat! Rat, don't run to them! They talk about ghosts and hauntings, UFOs and all kinds of supernatural scary stuff.
You'll never understand, will you, Scarlet?
No!
Well, that's your misfortune.
Rat! 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 Rat, if you go, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear... Line!
Oh, you gotta be kidding.
That's the Paranormal View with your host, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, and Barbara Duncan. Every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on the ParaX Radio Network.
There's a darkness in the hallway. Voices that seem to come from nowhere. Alone at night, there is a feeling that something or someone is near. Where can you go? Who can you turn to? ParaX Radio. Our knowledgeable host and expert guest can help you find some answers and take a glimpse into the unknown. ParaX Radio. Programming for the open mind.
And welcome back, everybody, to the Paranormal View right here on the ParaX Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for dropping by tonight. Great chat room, great guest, and we've got questions all over the place. I got one also from chat room from Tabby Cat, and she wanted to know, what is your biggest obstacle in getting a law enforcement agency to believe in your visions?
It come to the point where in the last 10 years, I don't get them to believe. They call me. One coined phrase from a detective is I'm on the Rolodex. So when I get a call from a family, let's say first, it starts out with a family. Then I say, get the detective to contact me. Here's my credentials. Here's my dossier. Now, when you present a dossier, when it has all the detectives you worked with, all the cases you've solved, they look at that and they go, oh, okay, well, this guy's real. He's legit. So I've done a lot of stuff with a lot of different detectives, you know, and even them calling me. Like I said, I'm home. I've worked several different cases with different detectives like Andy DeLay on 40. I did a double homicide in Kentucky with him when he was in Kentucky. And then I found the missing endangered lady for him in Florida just this past March. It took only me about, I'd say, between 45 minutes and an hour and found her and brought her home alive. That book's in the whole story is in the book, but that was a real fast rundown about that. I don't know. I don't have that problem. I just don't. They just know who I am.
Now, a follow-up question to that would be, have you ever been asked to testify as a psychic? And if not, do you think that down the road that it's going to be more commonplace for psychics to work with law enforcement and be treated as a witness?
Yeah, your latter part of your question, I said this years ago, that sooner and later coming up, that an individual like myself who works directly with law enforcement, who are on that so-called, you know, quote-unquote, whatever, Rolodex, they call it, who are a tangible asset for the police, I see it where we are going to be in court and we're going to have to give evidence of how we came up with this and explain our vision in order how to get the gun in the wall. You knew it was there. So, you know, we have to put that in place to show that the detectives were able to get that warrant to go into that and found it and makes it feasible. there's going to be some type of workmanship there that will come forward that way. Have I ever been in court? The closest thing I've ever been in court. Now, everybody's going to have a little laugh at this one. I got asked by a detective to show up at the courthouse, not to do anything, just sit there, because they knew that these people who were involved in this big fraud case knew me or knew what I was doing or what I do. So I said, okay. And I taught self-defense for years to a lot of police officers. So this one detective, she asked me to go up. I used to teach her karate all the time. So I went up, I sat there, and it was pretty amusing watching this melee of people all over, and they all go for a recess, and I'm sitting still in the waiting room. One guy comes up the steps, and he says, are you here for the good guys or the bad guys? And I said, I'm here for the good guys. So yeah. He says, you're talking about, and he mentions her name. And I said, no. I said, I'm here for the other good guys. He looks at me, and he made a beeline downstairs, out the door, come, and all of a sudden you hear these footsteps coming up the steps. And then it's him and the individual who was doing the fraud. They looked at me, and in the meantime, in the interim, they made a deal that if this person would take it, the charges would be, you know, dropped a bit and whatever. So immediately looking at me, they made a beeline for the courtroom, and then the detective, after about half an hour or so, comes back out, smiling, laughing, and says, "Thank you, Rob. You did your job, and I don't need you anymore." So that's all they needed me for. That's the funniest thing, because it must have freaked her out as she ran in and took the plea bargain.
Wonderful. Yeah, when you do these, and if you ever do get called, do you ever worry about your own safety?
I go right up to them. I ain't scared. I work out daily in the gym. I'm not just boasting on my physique or how I am. I bench press over 300 pounds, and I work out very rigorously. I have my black belt. I'm not scared. I just don't have this fear, because you have to remember, I went through to be a police officer, and I want to do the right thing by people. And, you know, I have this saying, families come first, and I put the criminals where they belong. I think everything a police officer is, he strives with all his might and his soul to do the right thing in life, and that's to serve and protect. Although I am not a police officer anymore, as I was a long time ago, they consider me part of the blue line. They call me brother. They do. I've been on cases where they're hugging me and they're calling me brother. And, you know, these guys are great. So, I mean, you know, it's just something that you just don't fear. I mean, it's just the way it is. I don't fear it. But I got to add to this too. I'm around a lot of blue liners. So when I'm on a case, and I've had guns pulled on me, I mean, we were on a case down in Kentucky, and I remember Andy DeLay, he turns around and we're pacing off the double homicide, because he wanted to get every inch by inch of where this kid said he didn't see the fire and the smoke and yada, yada, yada. So we're down the lane, and I'm standing there, I'm talking to the sister of the one family member who was murdered. And then I hear Andy about 30 feet from me go, "I could pull my weapon faster than you could pull the trigger." And I look over at him and I'm going, "What are you yelling at?" And I look in the bush and there's a gun pointed right at me. So, I mean, I've had it pointed at me. We were filming with America's Most Wanted film crew. And, I mean, one of the suspects showed up at the hotel where we were at, and he had a gun. And we're not scared. I mean, and all of a sudden you see all the cops that are there chasing this guy. So, I mean, I got cops with guns around me. I don't know. I just don't have that fear. I don't fear.
Well, the question I was going to ask was, is it sort of like what they call the prophet's curse, where you can't see your own fate? Do you go into these situations psychically blind, where you're not going to see that?
No. I'm very aware of my surroundings. I'm very aware of, what I am and what I do. I've been doing this for 28 years, folks. I mean,
I'm not, if I was scared, I would have stopped years and decades ago. And something would have happened decades ago. No, I'm not. I'm just not that way. They fear, you got to look at it this way too. I know people have a hard time understanding this or equivocate this to looking at the murderer. They think the murderer, he's a mean monster. They're more fearful of us coming after them.
Did we lose
him? Oh, in? That's true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Robbie, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
I thought we lost you again.
Guess no, the end of, make no, it, guess, don't guess the end of a sentence and it just screeches halts, you know. Poof.
Stop.
You're making a very valid point.
Now, and you were talking afraid. A little bit earlier about the woman in Florida where the police down there called you. And I believe you went into channeling on that also to look and see what you could see on her. That case was called the Missing Endangered Lady in Pinellas County, Florida. They mentioned something in there that I was trying to figure out what it meant. And it was called, what is the term BOLO?
Oh, be on the lookout.
Oh, okay. I couldn't figure out what in the world that was saying.
Yeah, I know.
You don't watch enough cop shows, Henry.
No, I don't. But the woman ended up having, she had dementia and Alzheimer's. And
yeah,
that was, I couldn't figure out to first, just by reading the title, the Missing Endangered Lady. I thought maybe she needed her meds or something like that until the end. And then I seen where they were saying that she had dementia and Alzheimer's. Yeah, that would be a bad thing. Somebody wanders off from the home like that and nobody knows where she's at. She wouldn't even know where she's at. So that was an interesting story too.
Yeah. I mean, you had hundreds of cops looking for her, helicopter in the sky. And when I said she took a bus from Pinellas, California to Tampa Bay, they found her in Tampa Bay. The greatest thing about this whole book and everything too, when you read all that about the dementia and all that, that letter comes from the police officer, the detective himself. He's validating my work. In each case, they validate what I've done. I know there's parts of the book you didn't get. There's many more cases. But in there, they write out exactly the report, what took place, how it was solved. And that just, permeates the whole existence of that case. In other words, what they're doing is they're openly endorsing me for every case I've done. And it's just one hand washes the other. I mean, the whole fact about this is to give families faith and hope. I've talked to so many families and it's gut-wrenching when they say, all these years we didn't know, and it's hard for them. And when you sit there and you listen to their stories, your heart breaks. I mean, it literally gets torn out of your chest because they want their baby back. And you can't get them baby back, but you can give them some type of reprieve or solace to find some type of justice for what was going on.
Now, earlier you had mentioned, actually Henry has mentioned that you channel. Is it a difference than, say, remote viewing?
Channeling and remote viewing is like when I'm in Canada and they show me the picture of the 4-year little boy and I'm staring at his picture and I start gleaning in visions of stadium lights off and I put circles on the diagram and all my drawings and stuff are all in the book too. And then I'm drawing this monster that I see through a 4-year-old's eyes, what he looks like. And you take his mugshot in the picture I draw, and you take a look at the ears and the distinction of what it all is, it's exactly him through the 4-year-old little boy's eyes. Wow. And when I put repeat offender of two boys, the man was a sexual predator of two other boys and was charged before. Then he ends up murdering this 4-year-old little boy. So I scream out.
That case was the Caesar Cano case. That happened in Louisville?
Yes, that's correct.
And they had called you wanting to, or matter of fact, it was a woman that emailed you and said that yes. they could help. And yes. It wasn't the police that called you on that. She did. That was a very, very interesting story.
Yes.
In one sense, it had a bad ending. The other sense, it had a good ending because you yeah. caught the guy. But do you think that if they would have acted on the things that you were saying quickly, that they might have got to him before that happened? Or do you think it he was already passed by then?
Yeah. What, you know, I toil over this because all the information I gave not only went to the detective, it went to the major television news station at the same time, to John Bowles. So, I mean, you got the news station having it, you have the police having it, you have the activist, the major activist in Louisville, Kentucky. He knows about it. And so they're all, everybody's out there searching for this beautiful little boy and doing their thing. You know, at one point, I know that they went up to the man's home and asked if he's seen the kid. And he said no. And that's when he got spooked, when the police left and he murdered him. He held the boy down in the bathtub and drowned him in the bathtub. Now, his excuse in court was he freaked out. He didn't know what to do. And so that was his excuse, to kill the boy. Now, you know, I'm looking at this and the way it all played out. The information, those police officers, they worked as diligently and as fast as they could and took all the information, because it was mentioned on the news that night that they got their break and they used all the information. They even said that to the activist and everybody that's pertinent to this story, that they used all the information in the leads and the name that I came up with of the murderer himself. So they knew who it was.
Which, after they had found his body, they went back and started looking at the things that you had sent, and that's what led them to Cecil.
That was their break. They went and arrested Cecil December 7th of 2007.
Which was, what, 5 months or so after he'd been killed?
Cecil went on the lam. He took off, and they found the boy's body. It was pretty much, you know, that week. And then they knew. And then Cecil's gone. So they were looking for Cecil. But they arrested him, and they got him December 7th.
Wow. How many cases have you been involved with that had bad endings like this?
Oh, you know, too many to count. It's disparaging when you talk about it. But there's just a lot of bad. But when you look at it, like you mentioned, there's a good outcome to it. Although, and then one person said this to me, was Keith Age. He followed this case that time I did it in 2007. He was on the phone actually too, with the police, me, everything too. There was a lot of people involved, and Keith was there, and he puts a quote up on my website there. Although I described the killer to a T, his name, everything, and what happened, it's a bittersweet, but the man got caught. Yeah, you know, it is a bittersweet. And, you know, looking at the amount of cases with the bad endings like this, there are lots. Like Barbara mentioned earlier, I wish I could have that information or that ability, or how do you turn out and say that this is going to happen, stop it. You know what I mean? It hasn't gotten to that point. You know, it hasn't gotten to that 9.0 earthquake, you know, warn everybody in Japan, or, you know, 2 days before Victoria goes missing, I get the vision exactly where they find her body and who did it. I mean, I profiled the two people who did it. Yeah, it's very discouraging. I don't know what to say about it.
Yeah,
well, let's take the reverse of that, which is the happier endings. And doesn't that make it all worthwhile in the long run when you have the ability to grab somebody out of human trafficking, for example?
Yeah, that was – this lady followed me since the mid-1990s, before there was Yahoo, Twitter, most of your social media, MySpace and all that. She followed me. It was the Robbie Thomas forums. I used to have like 10,000 plus people follow me. I talked a lot about spirituality, a lot of things about, you know, your dreams, you as a person. It was a positive aspect. And so she ended up calling me up one day here in the mid-2000s and said, I never thought I'd have to use you. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And she says, my daughter is missing. And she's gone into the human trafficking. They took her. I said, oh, my gosh. She says, the detective is done. He's at odds. He has nowhere to do. So I discussed you with him. He said to call you, so I'm calling you. So I said to her, okay. We sat down for a minute. I'm talking to her on the phone. And then all of a sudden, I came up with this. I envisioned it. I said, this is what you got to do. And I laid it out for her. I told her exactly what she had to do. And she said, no, my family is conservative. There's no way I'm doing that. And we got into a heated discussion. We ended the phone call. It was going nowhere. She ended up calling me back. It was sometime after. And we're talking the next day. And I said, okay. And she goes, yeah, you know, you're right. I have to put my daughter first, regardless of what anybody thinks. I said, that's right. You have to stop thinking what other people think. Start thinking about what your daughter, your life. Who cares what people think? It doesn't matter. They're not going to pay your bills. They're not going to help you do things. They're not going to get off their butts to do it. You got your daughter. You got to look after. That's number one. And so she said, yeah. And so she did what I said. And that was about a Friday. And then Sunday, her daughter came home. She had her daughter.
Amazing.
And she says,
but even that was a struggle.
And that was a struggle. Oh, Barbara, it was a struggle. I mean, it was, when I'm talking, we discussed a lot. We had long conversations on the phone, and it was a struggle. It was heated, and to the point where we're going back and forth at each other. But that's a good conversation, constructive, because look what happened in the end. It came out, and she writes a big letter, and she puts it in the book, and she writes out in capital letters, and he brought my daughter home alive.
Wow. I got another question from the chat room from Cater, and he wanted to know, have you ever been wrong?
You know, looking back, I've been asked that question many times. Look back, the only example of ever being wrong is that I write a chapter in the book called The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. I pull punches because, you know, I've been doing this for too long. I don't care what people think. I don't care what people say. And when I get called by a family, I'm for them. I don't care what skeptics say. I don't care what Cater says. I'm not saying that in a bad way. I'm just trying to think of somebody else. But, I mean, I don't care what anybody thinks. I go in, I do it. I go in, I talk to the murderers. I go in and I chase these guys because that's what I do. I look at families. And then sometimes it goes well, sometimes it don't, because we're doing something in a case. Families always want to butt in, and I see the prerogative. I see their point. I understand it, but you have to separate feelings and family from what I'm doing. So I have to really separate that. And when you say it gets heated, yeah, it gets heated. And then they don't like what I say, it's tough. I'm there to find your daughter. I don't care how you feel about me. I'm going to do the job, and I'm going to get it done for you. In the end, we'll hug, we'll kiss, and we'll make up. But I don't care what you think. So, you know, doing what I do, and you call me for a reason, I'm not playing a game. You call me, I travel thousands of miles from my country to my wife coins a phrase. She calls it perfect strangers. I go out of my life from my family and put my life on the line for perfect strangers. And she hit it right. So when I go out and do these things, and the family says to me, oh, you know, you're wrong. And we didn't. I said, well, look what you did. You messed the case up because you brought in a mall cop and you brought in somebody who said he was a cop and he wasn't a cop. I got international police chief Kevin Smith, and he's working with me on this. very high ranking officer in the world. I got America's Most Wanted here. They're filming. And you're screwing this freaking thing up. I mean, you don't belong here. Go back to your house. We're going to do this. You know, that's how I am. I'm very straightforward. You got something wrong with your family. You need it fixed. I'm coming in to help you. There's that point where the, you know, the nicey nicey stuff. Yeah, but stop it. I don't know how to say it. I'm just like a straightforward guy. I get on the job. I'm doing it. And that's just the way it is. Certain things happen in cases. One case, going back to Cata, and Seattle. A girl goes missing. Lady calls me up and says, my daughter's been missing. My ex-husband took her. I said, okay, what happened? She said, well, we went through court. I won custody, and he went and took my daughter, and she's gone. I said, oh, my gosh. So, all right, let's start this. So I started going through it. Then I'm talking to the detective. The detective fills me in that she's a mail order bride from over the country, Romania or whatever. And he goes, she's really weird. I said, okay, fine. I got that in the back of my head, but I'm still here for the child. You know, that story, okay. Then I started finding out that the male, the husband, his family is even more weird. They have tunnels from their houses that go underneath to each other's house. They don't use front doors. They use tunnels to go to their houses. And I said, how the hell does that happen in this day and age? How do you allow this to happen? And he's telling me a story, and I'm thinking, this is really weird, and it's busted out there. So I give my reading. I do my thing. I say, I see him up in Canada. That's how he came up through Minnesota in that area. All right, time goes by. All of a sudden, I get this phone call from her. She goes, I got this snapshot from Quebec. And she goes, I think it's Quebec. Can you take a look at it? And it's got French signs. I said, yeah, that looks like Quebec. She goes, when you go underground, folks, there's people above ground searching for you. So just as many people who hold you underground, if you steal a child and you go underground, there's just as many people above ground searching for you. So the people snap a shot of this guy. He's supposed to be in Quebec. And I'm, yep, that's it. Confirm it. She goes over to tell the detective now, and he pulls me off the case. So I'm thinking, am I that wrong? I'm not wrong. I was right. The guy's in Canada. So that's the closest thing I could get to being wrong. And I think the reason why he pulled me off the case, I hate using the word think. I feel that the reason why is I was onto something too much that was bigger than what we all know right now I've explained to you. Because the detective wanted nothing to do with these people.
You're getting your nose into stuff that doesn't concern you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, there's some pretty dark things out there. And I'm wondering, you know, number one, is there some cases that you would just as soon walk away from? But also, are there cases, cold cases out there that if you ever get the time, would love to start pursuing again?
You know, there's a lot of cold cases out there. A lot of them. And I feel for the families that sit back. And I got a lot of beautiful families on my social media, and I talk to them all. And, you know, it's one case after another, but I got to take time because I'm the only one person. So right now I'm working a big high case in L.A., Jeffrey's gonna want to know that one. Yeah.
Well, Jeffrey want to meet you eventually.
Well, yeah, I'm working with LAPD on that one. It's really uncanny, Jeffrey. I'll tell you off air because it's something I can't let out.
Right.
So, doing that, and again in Washington, and then in the interim. Now I've been there's a lot of things come up in the last week since this book's come out, and I'm just overwhelmed by TV and everything. So I'm trying to pace things right, make it in order that it's for the family still. Keep family focused, right? So that's what I'm trying to do. These older cases, I've been on a few of them, and we get resolved, which is good. And it's difficult for some families. It really is, because sometimes you turn around and you're doing an old case, but you find out the murderer is dead. How do you get justice? You know, and then the lady tells me, but you solved it, and, you know, we're happy in the end here, but you still feel that there's something missing. There's something missing from them and their heart, and, you know.
Well, at least you know that, you know, it's not going to hurt anybody else.
True. That's true. But, you know, it's very difficult all around when you are the only one in focus. And like I said, it's encompassing. It's very encompassing as an individual who does things for people who are perfect strangers. And I don't want to come off in the wrong light to people, because I'm not. I'm trying to stay focused. And you don't want a wishy-washy person on a murder case. You don't want somebody who's wishy-washy trying to find your daughter of the sex slave trade and bring her home alive. You want somebody who's going to be direct and honest. And I think I'm the most direct, honest individual that I can be for people.
Now, you're still working with different police agencies. Do you ever all of a sudden get a vision of something and contact the police to tell them?
No, that's a question I've always been asked too. I did a show with detectives, or actually the host of the show. One's a lieutenant and one's I think it was a captain. Very, very distinguished individuals. We discussed one case that's very high profile right now, and they've had a slew of people who call themselves psychic call in or email in information. Now, they weren't contacted to be brought in on this case. They just emailed and phoned in. What people don't understand is all that information that they get, they have to follow, because it's a potential lead. So when I talk to Danny, he says, you know, everything that comes in our office, we have to follow. So if we get something on there that looks tangible, and if it takes a week or two or three or four, and it comes at the end that it's no good, it's a foiled attempt. We lost all that time, all the man hours, all that wasted expenditure of costs, everything. And then we turn back and we got hundreds of those sitting on our desk. It's very difficult. So I don't ambulance chase. I never have. Let me take that back. The only time I did was Victoria Stafford, the girl who went missing. I seen everything happened when she went missing. I knew. And it was a town about an hour and a half, 2 hours from where I live. And I contacted the family. And sure enough, well, the two did it are in jail.
Wow. Cater again wanted to know, with your 27 years of doing this, have you ever got any advice, words, or have you ever got any advice, words of wisdom for us? Has he learned anything about life, humanity through his practice over the years?
Yeah, I learned love people. I love people. Life is precious. Every moment is precious. If you're ever on my social media every day, I wish everybody the best. Every morning I wake up and my first post to everybody who's on there is, I wish you all the best and I send you love. I want that for everybody. You know, the people who take the time of their life to become bad, it's just not an overnight thing. It's in them. It's, you know, so I've learned that through my own consciousness of life itself. Respect everything in life and people. That's what I do. I don't know if you call it words of wisdom or just my prerogative, but, you know, for people in life who are wanting, you know, I get this a lot too, guys. I get people email me at least, you know, every week I get two or three people. I want to be like you. I want to do what you do. No, you don't. You really don't. It's not a fantasy. It's horrible. I look at autopsy pictures. I see things that are people shouldn't see. And then I know that I talk to a lot of homicide detectives who are on my page too, on my social medias. And I kid around with them. I say, you know, your whole career of 30 years being a homicide detective, I've done more homicides than you have in your whole 30 years. It's sad to say that. It really is. So like words of wisdom is just love life, love yourself. in your family, your children, everybody who's involved in your life. Show that respect. And, you know, that's all I always pound into people. You know, life is very precious. Live it fully every day.
Now, do you do readings for people?
Yeah, I do. I got on my page, I have readings, and I've been to conventions. I do readings there for people when I go to the conventions and in person.
Okay, now I have to ask, with recent news, etc., do you find that the atmosphere out there is just a little bit more tense?
Can you repeat that again? I'm sorry.
With the recent news, etc.
Yeah.
The mass shootings, etc.
Right.
Do you find that violence tends to be a little bit more prevalent in people, or is it just coming out more in people?
You know, we can look at it that way, that social media and media itself, news media, it's more prevalent, or, you know, has it been this way a lot? No, I think it's there's something going on. I mean, there's other countries that don't have mass shootings like this. You know, there's countries who have guns, but they don't have mass shootings. We can make a list of them, like Australia, Japan, Canada, you know, very low. I don't understand it. I don't know what to make of it. I made a post the other day, and I got a lot of beautiful people, again, on my page from America and Canada and all around the world. But I'm hurt. I think the whole world's hurt by this. And when we see children who are taken from us by a senseless act, and then the parents have to sit there and bury their babies, I mean, where, I just can't wrap my head around that. I just can't. And it's just not in Florida. It's everywhere. I mean, it's happening all around the states. And then all of a sudden, I click on different social media, and they said, oh, they prevented a copycat over here, and then they arrested this guy over here, and then somebody's grandmother called in and got the grandson arrested because he was going to kill. I'm thinking, what's going on over there? I just don't get it. We can't, you know, we have to find a solution. We have to find a solution for these children and the temperament of the society that we have, and find a solution quick, because we can't have this anymore. It's not good.
I feel like a lot of it, if you look back 25, 30 years, you didn't see all this violence like that. I think a lot of it has come about through social media. Everybody is on social media. Kids are following it. Kids see this. Kids see that. And if they can do it, so can I. And I think that has a lot to do with it, is social media.
Yeah, I think you're right, too. I talked to my wife about that the other day. I said, let's go back when we had no social media. I mean, there was no pressures in wanting to belong to a clique. There was no pressures in wanting to be that popular person or popular group or whatever you want to call it. I mean, I just don't understand. I think it's the pressures of that, the peer pressure. You know, if you're not liked and you're bullied, I mean, The new stigmata is the bullying online. And you see all these children taking their lives because of the bullying, too, or they're fighting back by hurting other people. There's something that has to be done. It truly does.
Yeah. Maybe they should ban all kids on social media.
No, I don't know. You know, I have something.
I think that's what it is. I mean, peer pressure and stuff. I mean, yeah, when I was growing up in school, yeah, you'd have some guy get mad at somebody else, and after school they'd go out and swing fists a couple of times and it was over with and you go home. It's just not like that anymore. So
no.
Anyway, we're wrapping up pretty close toward the end here. Barbara, you got a couple other questions real quick?
Well, I was wondering, when it looks like you do gallery readings of a sort. I know a lot of psychics will say that they just get inundated at that point. Do you feel inundated when you do gallery reading types, and how do you filter out all of that information?
I went on, I toured many years, for many years, all over the United States to, you know, through Canada. When I did the 2010 Psychic Justice Tour, I helped out on a lot of different murder cases with law enforcement. So I would bring families, like stop in Ohio, Iowa, Kentucky, Indiana, and bring families in there and read them on stage, or I'd be on stage and come down to the family in the audience and read them on their loved one and tell to give them information while the police were there that was pertinent to their case, and then go to the next family and read them and pertinent to them. I get like tunnel vision, and it's like I focus on you and you only. And then when I turn to the other people, I'm focused on you and you only. And whatever information I'm getting is from their loved ones and spirit guides and God is just coming in for them. You know, it's, I don't feel cumbersome. I don't feel, you know, entrapped into where I got all this energy from different people coming in, because I'm focused on that individual and that family. You know, I've done it before. Like, again, like all these different tools I've done. 2007, the Power of Spirit Tour, New Orleans and all over. I just love people. I love going out and doing it. And, you know, reading people is great, because it's that tie. I usually say, I call it like the genealogical tie. And it gets that moment with them and their family or loved one or their life. They want to know what's going on or what's wrong with their health. And I remember being at the last Mid-South and people coming up, and I couldn't get a room because it was just too many people. So I just said, oh, you know what, I'm going to do it right here. And I just kept reading people right there at my booth with everybody else all around. And the noise and all the congestion just went away. And I focused on people, and I told them what they needed to hear, from medical to whatever. And, you know, they're crying and they're going, you're right. And you know, oh my gosh. And you know, that's not I'm being right. It's us, and we're finding a solution. We're doing something here, and we're getting the right answers for you from whomever you're coming with. I that's how I describe it.
That's nice. So you have tours coming up again?
Yeah, there's been people asking me, please go on tour again. Come on tour. If there's anybody out there who's doing a conference, whatever, you want to get me to your conference. I know it's kind of hid in the shadows, because I know a lot of stuff that I'm doing coming up in filming and what have you. Contact me. We'll try to work something out and get me to wherever, and we'll do some touring. They asked me if I was going to do a book tour because of this new book coming out. I even kind of dashed that away because of the fact that the new stuff that's coming out. I know Jeffrey wasn't on the conversation of us prior to the show, and we could fill him in after, but it's very heavy. It's something big. And if it goes well, oh my goodness, I hope I can reach out to more people than normal.
And the question I have is, you work with local law enforcement. Have you worked with the FBI?
All the time, Scott.
Right now, apparently. We did a case. Are we off air?
No. No.
Oh, sorry. I thought I heard that. I'm sorry. That's my quagmire. Anyways, yeah, we were doing a case in Washington. The FBI found the car in Virginia. But then I worked with the DSA, and it was a CIA individual's daughter who was murdered. And they brought in NSA. NSA was there, didn't really speak to the gentleman, and it was very different, but it was neat to watch how the algorithms and whatever he was trying to figure out and what was going on. But I've worked with that many types of different high individuals.
Oh, okay. So it's not just local law enforcement. You're pretty much all over the place.
Yeah, like I said, the one detective called me the Rolodex.
Rolodex.
Yeah. Oh, I got a feeling that's gonna stick, and I don't want it to.
Because who writes numbers down anymore when you just put in your phone?
Yeah. We got people already asking for you to come back, so. Which is good.
I'll come back. I love you guys.
Yeah, I'll probably get to see you sometime this year. I may try and be able to go down to Louisville this year. I know I got Gettysburg in April, so we'll have to see how things go. And so with that, our time is got about 4 minutes here. I guess it's too early for you to do that, but maybe next time when you come on, maybe we could, if you'd like to do some readings, you know, just small, quick readings for people, we could do some of those. Jeff, Barbara, you guys got anything else here real quick?
You'd mentioned on one of the previous times you've been on, and yeah, it's been years, and you were developing Psychic Profiler. What progress is that? Is that actually going to come together as some sort of a TV series or what?
Well, that's the point I want to talk to you off air about.
It's not that I'm lazy, but when we have a returning guest, what I normally do is I go back to the report page of their previous appearance, because a lot of times there'll be links and references to things that I already have the links to, so I don't have to go looking them up again. And I was just kind of glancing at it saying, well, let's see what we didn't talk about today, I can delete. And I just say because, oh, back then he was still talking about it as a TV show, so... And like Scarborough Fair and things like that.
Yeah. Well, a little hint would be that for this whole week, I've been in discussions with an Emmy award-winning film director. Oh. And it's very hot. So I want to leave it at that. And as soon as I hear more, I will definitely come back and talk to you guys about it and who the police chief I'm working with now as a partner. And it'll be really great. But I want everybody out there, you know, much love to you all. And everybody's tuning in. We talked about social media tonight. And I just want to get a little last word in here, if I can, about our children. Now, this book, sure, it has a lot of missing persons and murder cases in it. It has a slew of endorsements from every law agency, whatever, Crime Stoppers, chief of police, different police, RCMP, everything. That doesn't really matter. What really matters is the little bit I have in the book for families. And that is the social media. We talked about that. I write about social media in the book and about your children. Pay attention to that. And also I write about the good, the bad, the ugly. And there's three different parts of that big chapter. Don't look at it in the bad way. Look at it in the good way. Read between the lines. That's for families. And I'm trying to give some love out there to people so they can understand. And hopefully you don't have to call me. And I pray for that. I never want to see you. And, you know, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. So Psychic Profiler, The Real Deal, True Crime Cases, Volume 1. It's on Amazon. Please go get it.
Give out your information real quick, like of where they can get in contact with you, your websites, and all the other good stuff.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, RobbieThomas.net. It's pretty simple. Just RobbieThomas.net. All the information is there, too. You can take a look at it. And all the history of all the different cases I've done. They're all on the murder missing persons cases. And I even did a thief. I caught a thief for people. You know, and the letters there from the people that did it. Oh, my goodness. Love you guys. Thanks for having me.
All right. We want you to stay until after we're off here. Jeff?
Yes, we can go to the facebook.com/theparanormalview, all one word, for our on Facebook stuff, where I try to find interesting articles throughout the week to post. You can follow me at Real Badger, both on Twitter and on Instagram. And we should also mention, I don't know, is timeshiftthebook.com still online, Robbie?
No,
for your
no,
other book
actually,
you mentioned earlier?
No, the, yeah, no, that's off that's, the air, but you can get it on my robbiethomas.net.
Okay, cool. Sounds cool. And cool. Okay, there you go.
All right. We will see you next week at the same time because our time is running out.
So, whoa, big time.
Step outside of your comfort zone. See the world with a whole new perspective. Join us and experience the unexplained on the Paranormal View.